Hey, thanks to all of you who have already subscribed to the Pointless Exercise newsletter. And for those of you who haven't, I don't know why you haven't, it's getting rave reviews. Like Rex Reed from Vanity Fair said, Pointless Exercise is a thing that exists. We're extending the 15% off sale until Friday. Seemed weird to end it at midnight on a Wednesday. So now you'll have until the end of the day Friday. So go to pointlessexercise.com and sign up for the newsletter and you get 15% off for the first year. Well, I can see you're a fine connoisseur of podcasts because you're here at the Pointless Exercise Podcast. And I'm not sure which podcast you're listening to, although I probably could customize this commercial to all of them, but I'm not going to do that. So I'm going to give you a quick rundown of the current podcast lineup, pointlessexercise.com, to make sure you're not missing anything. First of all, there's the award-winning Cubs podcast that I've been doing for years. The lineup changes all the time, but you're always stuck with me. This year, same guys are back from last year, Sam Fells from Deadspin, and Kyle Reichert from Wisconsin, and now he lives in Chicago. Then there's a couple of newish podcasts. There's Remember This Crap with Mike Donahue. If you haven't heard this, you're in for a treat. We put Mike's encyclopedic memory for banal events in Chicago sports history, especially the Cubs and the Bears, to the test. We are going to try to hit every Cubs season between 1980 and 2011 at some point during this. So tune in. It's a lot of fun. We throw out a year and we just start remembering crap. And then, as if that's not enough, there's the Movie Deep Dive podcast with actor, comedian, and our Bear expert, which has nothing to do with this podcast, Mike Pusateri, where we pick some of our favorite movies and we do exactly what it sounds like. We dig deep into it. We dig up sound clips. We talk about the cast. We talk about the directors. We talk about how the movie got made. And we talk about our favorite parts in the movies. So that's plenty of podcasts, and you only have to go to one place to find them. That's pointlessexercise.com.
Don Bailey would love to have a cakewalk every now and then, but this ball club is not going to do that. They're going to get great pitching, some timely hitting, good defense. And when you have all those ingredients, add them all up, it's going to be 1 and 2 run ball games.
Broken bat, flare, left field, base hit. Ricky around third. Here comes the throw. Ricky fell down. And now the Cubs have runners all over the place. Fasano throws to second. Girardi in a rundown between first and second. Helton lets Girardi off the hook. Nobody's at first. There's the tag out. Runner coming home. He is out. Safe. Cubs win.
The stretch, kick and pitch. There's a fly ball. Going deep to right. Back goes Sosa. That's a winner. That's a game winner. Wow. Preston Wilson. A 3-run homer. With 2 out and 2 strikes in the bottom of the ninth. Wow. What a ball game.
Welcome back to another exciting edition of the Pointless Exercise Podcast. It's time to remember this crap with Mike Donahue. Mike, how are you doing?
Good, Andy. Watching the Cubs score their first run in about 17 innings and basically just go down in another weak, frustrating effort has, provided me the opportunity to look forward to this.
They're red hot. They got multiple hits today. I believe it took them, until the 7th? To get one. And then I think they got their second in the 8th. They're pacing themselves. You can't waste all these hits early in the season. Yeah. They're gonna come August and September, they're gonna average like 28 hits a game. It's gonna be a sight to see.
Sign me up. In the meantime though, in all seriousness, it does get frustrating, obviously, and it has been for years. But now I'm actually looking forward to this because who knows, maybe we'll spin on a winning season after wallowing through a couple of mediocre seasons through the Tribune mediocrity by design.
Yeah, we might. We'll maybe we'll hit a big one. So, I suppose I should plug. Well, I don't have to. There's a commercial before us. I don't have to plug the Pointless Exercise newsletter. Although, perfect. If you want to sign up, you can. The way this podcast works is we have a wheel that has every year from 1980. Is that when we started?
Yep.
To 2011. Poor Mike Quadi got left out. No, Dale's Fame got left out. Mike Quadi. Dale. Hopefully 2011 goes last. We'll save the best for last. We spin the wheel, and whatever year it lands on, we're talking about it. We haven't done any research. We haven't done anything. It's remember this crap. We're just going to try to remember stuff. It's much more exciting than it sounds. So far, this is the third edition of this, the Cub version of this podcast. We did an entire Bear season. You can go back and listen to those. We have so far done the exciting years of 1997 and 1992. And we are about to spin the wheel, and the only proviso we have is that if it lands on, because we did 92 last week, if it lands on 91 or 93, we're going to re-spin, because it's a little too close. It's always going to be basically the same clowns, just a different circus.
You can only have so much Luis Salazar in your diet on a multiple-week basis, so, you know.
So, but here we go. We're going to spin the exciting wheel, and if you hear the sound effect, it's going to sound a lot like the sound effect for the wheel that we spin for the movie podcast, mostly because it is the same wheel with different stuff on it. Oh, look what's coming.
Give me a one. Give me a one. This will be good.
2001. Very great. Okay, so the way we start now is off the top of your head, you're going to tell me five things about the 2001 Cubs.
Five fast facts off the top of my head. This is the first Cubs team in our lifetime that legitimately contended for the postseason and failed. That's fact number one. Fact number two, it was Don Baylor's second season and his only winning season for the Cubs. Fact number three, there might not have been a hotter relief pitcher in April of that year than Jeff Fusaro, who picked up for the newly signed and yet opening up the season injured Tom Flash Gordon, stepped into the closer's role, and I believe earned saves in about the first six games. Cubs got off to a good start. Fact number four, 2001 Cubs, Sammy Sosa had what is easily statistically the most ridiculously powerful offensive season in Cubs history, and would probably rank in the top 10 of all time. We know it's the steroid era, but everything being relative, incredibly impressive. We'll take a dive into that, I'm sure. And then fact number five, 2001 Cubs, what can I tell you? That's the year the Cubs drafted Mark Pryor, but I would expect a little more Pryor talk in subsequent years, because he had to pitch in the World Series, the College World Series that season, and didn't actually come up until the next year. But they did draft him. Things were looking pretty good in 01. So,
okay, so you mentioned Jeff Fusaro being hot. And I think you mean that in more than one way. Because as a handsome man, do you remember what the Discipio nickname for Jeff Fusaro was?
Holy crap, I cannot.
He was
the troll.
He was the troll. And he had this weird thing on his right earlobe. Like, I'm glad we didn't have HD, because I don't think we could have taken it. But there was something growing on his earlobe. But yes, he had a bout of greatness that unfortunately he could not sustain.
I was pressured to know that answer. And I did know that later, but I was not actually following Discipio in 2001. 2003 was my first year. But even though Fusaro was gone, I think he pitched for the Cardinals, I do now remember that was – but that's pretty good coinage. And I do remember that earlobe thing of good old Jeff Fusaro.
All right, so the 2001 Cubs, 88-74. They were an excellent home team, 48-33 at home, 40-41 on the road. The old win, you know, win the majority of your game. Well, what are you supposed to win? Two-thirds of your games at home and go 500 on the road and you're a playoff team? They didn't quite do that.
Something like that.
Did they have a losing month?
They may not have. They were, I know that they had a like a 9-game winning streak in late May, early June that had come on the heels of like a 7-game losing streak. So I'm going to say, I'm going to guess no, but that if they did, it would have been May of 2001.
They had two, and they're just the months you want them to be.
May and September?
August and September.
Oh, yeah. Well,
they, and then they were 500 in 6 games in October. Remember, the season went late that year because there was a very sad, like a week where there were no games after the towers fell.
Yeah, due to the September 11th bombings, one of the upshots to that would be that the first World Series game played in November would take place in 2001. That happens sometimes now.
How many days do you think the 2001 Cubs spent in first place?
I can make a calculated guess here because they were in first place. Actually, I'm pretty sure they were for a good chunk of the summer. Into August. So, well, and they were above 500 in May. I'm going to say they spent 79 days in first place, more than half the season.
If you count only the days that there were games played, they spent 96 days in first place. If you count all days of the season, including off days, 112.
Okay.
They fell out of first place on August 17th, never to return.
Okay.
They had on June 22nd, they had a 6-game lead in the NL Central. And on September 27th, they were 9 games behind.
I can, just from like memory, I can kind of remember the flow of the season. They, first of all, as far as just providing the context going in, it was, like I said at the top, it was Baylor's second season, and it was also we were still, this is the third time that we're doing Tribune Era 2, you know, mediocrity by design. But it was a little bit different than the other two because this season it actually kind of worked. A team that they had slapped together that was designed to be, you know, okay, they're going to draw and they might, you know, the combinations might work and they're going to be in contention. And it was actually, it was a fun season. I generally, in spite of the heartbreak, which we'll get into some games down the stretch, no doubt, it was generally a kind of a positive season. And it was coming on the heels of a very this season, even though there was Don Baylor coming in 2000, they were still kind of a mess. Ed Lynch had gotten fired somewhere around 2000. So even within Tribune 2, there was some moving parts in the front office. There, you know, even if this the system that they had designed was operating pretty efficiently from year to year, you know, I think maybe for no other reason than cosmetic purposes, they made moves like get rid of Ed Lynch and eventually groom Jim Henry for the job. But oddly enough, in 2001, this was sort of the gap year where Mr. Sweater Vest himself, Andy McVail, was forced to, even though he was running a profitable franchise, they were, you know, they'd maybe been a little too bad in 99 and 2000, and he was actually having to come downstairs and serve as the GM. So
yes, he had to humble himself by doing a job.
By doing a job, which he thought he would never have to do again after he, you know, was able to catapult himself out of Minnesota. So, so going in, so what do you have? You know, I mean, Kerry Wood is obviously promising, but he's, you know, oft injured. And, you know, John Lieber is reliable. Lieber would go on to have his best year as a Cub. And that was part of the thing that made is a lot of players really sort of came together and had really good years, which if they were really good players would have probably had a much more, even more positive outcome. But instead you had, you know, like Ricky Gutierrez, just, you know, kind of holding it down at short. Bill Miller is your third baseman till his knee got shredded in May. And so they had to hang it out with, you know, future broadcaster Ron Coomer and his .299 on base percentage. Yes.
Former Cub and All-Star. Ron,
yes,
very, very carefully worded by Virgil Patrick Hughes.
Rondell White, Ron D.L. White, who I loved it.
Yes, one of my favorites. He just couldn't, when he played, he was awesome. He just didn't play very much.
great right-handed hitter. Left field when he was healthy. And, you know, Corey Patterson was still, we had hope for him. So there was, you know, there was some promise. We'll get into Sosa maybe later, but I just wanted to say going into the season, though, you know, we didn't really know what we had. We didn't know what we had in Patterson, right? He actually showed us some things there. So it could have gone bad there. We weren't sure. Bill Miller was just the good glove man that they got for Tim Worrell. So, but they got off to a good start. And they got off to a good start mostly because of their starting pitching and Fassero stepping in to get those saves. They lost the first two games against the Expos, hung in there, and took one, and they kind of they got a little bit hot, and they got good outings out. It seemed like Wood, and I think Wood almost finally made it through a season uninjured until August. He had to do a couple weeks, but Wood had a nice season. Lieber had a really good season, but they also got good years out of 3 and 4, which Jason Beret, believe it or not, had filled in very well. And Christ, Andy, I hope you're looking at it because I couldn't even tell you the third pitcher right now off the top of my head. So I'm a little bit verklempt. But the fifth starter was essentially Julian Taveras. And they all pitched well early on. And they, you know, got timely hitting and they won close games and Fassero nailed them down.
You have forgotten an all-time great that we mentioned in the podcast last week. Him and Jaime Navarro.
That's it. Oh, Tappany. Right. Okay. So even Tappany was he there in that rotation?
He made 29 starts for them. He was 37 years old.
Okay. He, my guess is, and I'm not looking at it, but he must have pitched well. It just felt like
he did not pitch terribly well.
He did okay. Well,
9-14 with a 4.49 ERA.
Well, I'm going to guess that a lot of that happened late. It just felt like they were clicking early. They were an overachieving team, and they were clicking. And so, and you take you through. They come into early May for one of their early tests. I remember this vividly. And they go into St. Louis with this 30-year-old 22-year-old rookie. Who's like hitting everything in sight. And the Cubs go into a big showdown, early season showdown in St. Louis. And, you know, of course I'm talking about Albert Pujols, but they got swept. So many things happened in that series. Like the Friday night Pujols, I'm pretty sure went yard. First game he played the Cubs. Saturday game, or the Sunday game was the one I remember where Bill Miller, who was it, probably the best fielding third baseman I'd seen up until that point play for the Cubs. He went for a foul ball in Busch Stadium, tore up his leg. Fernando Vina took a pitch from Kerry Wood that was about to hit him in the face and got a triple down the line. It was a setback, but the Cubs bounced back. I know they had they did have a winning streak later on, and they were in it that summer. And so I remember being in fantasy baseball leagues and, you know, some of the more idiotic trash talk you'd engage in. Some dude's a Sox fan and he's like, Cubs always choke. And I'd always go out of my way to go on. No, the Cubs, they don't choke. That's the thing. They suck. But when they're in contention, they finished the deal, which up until that point in my lifetime, 84, 89, and 98. Those are the only three times the Cubs were legitimately a contender in August, and in all three cases, they went to the playoffs. As it turned out, 2001 would be the first team that was legitimately in the playoffs before bowing out. So I have three games in my head that, you know, that are like the signature games that happened those last 6 weeks. You mentioned August 17th. Being when they fell out of first place. And I'm just going to figure that somewhere around the time where Fassero, who had lost his effectiveness, gave up the grand slam to Ryan Klesko in San Diego.
Yes.
That's one. And then there's the Florida game. So we can look into all three of those. They're all back-breaking road losses.
All right. So let's get to this individual games in a minute. I want to go through this star-studded roster of theirs. So this was the first year without Mark Grace.
Yep.
And they replaced him. Do you remember, was the plan to replace him with two guys?
Nope.
It was supposed to be Matt Stairs, 5'8" Matt Stairs playing first base every day. Not him and Coomer platooning. Because where was Coomer supposed to play?
Coomer was not signed as a starter, really. He was sort of an extra. So maybe it was an all-star.
Pat tells us.
He was an all-star, of course, for all you youngsters at home because of the Major League Baseball rule that each team must send a representative to the all-star team. Sorry, Ron, but that's the truth. I believe it was 1999 where Ron Coomer earned his immortal distinction which will be, you know, is memorialized at baseballreference.com.
It's a constant reminder that every team has to have an all-star.
That's right. You know, I had nothing against Coomer as a player. He was like, he was a corner man, first base, third man. I think he played third for the Twins. It was designed for him to probably back up Stairs, because Stairs was a left-handed hitter. Maybe get lefty platoons. And it turned out they needed Coomer more than they expected, though, at third because of Miller's injury. So that really did hurt.
So do you remember the big free agent signing before the season?
Was it not Rondell?
No, I think they traded for Rondell.
Did they?
Yeah, this was a guy that this went so disastrously wrong that...
Of course. Todd Hundley.
Yes, he's a legacy.
That was the first year. I thought it was 2000 for a minute. You're right. Yeah. So,
do you remember where he came from?
He was the Dodgers, right?
Right. He'd gone from the Mets to the Dodgers, and then the Cubs would then, in one of Jim Hendry's best trades, would ship eventually him back to the Dodgers.
But two
useful pieces for one not very not useful piece.
And that's a signing you would put directly on Andy frickin' McPhail, because there was no nostalgia for Hundley. Let's, at least among knowledgeable fans, I think I told this story maybe in a Bears podcast somehow. I feel like I told the story, but I'm going to tell it again. I remember I worked in an office, and there were plenty of Cubs and Sox fans. There's another Cub fan named Mike, and I was good friends with him for a while, and we were, this is 2001, and Todd Hundley at that point, he was a local friend high school in Palatine. Obviously, he played for, he's the son of former Cub catcher Randy Hundley, and he had been an all-star himself legitimately. He was, I believe he may have become the Mets all-time leading home run hitter for a catcher, or he set some sort of a home run mark.
He hit 41 home runs in 1996, then 30 more in 97.
He was a switch hitting catcher, and he had a run. He was projected to do it. He was a first round pick. I remember when he was drafted around here, the local papers were all quick to point it out. Mets drafted him in '87. He was up by the early '90s. He showed some flash. There were probably myriad reasons why he didn't, wasn't able to sustain it. But just put it simply, I guess baseball is a tough game, and he got injured and he moved to left field at one point, and that was a disaster. I guess he still had a bat, but when they signed him, I just remember Mike and I in the office like, no, don't sign Todd. Like, there's, why would you? And it's just one of those deals where it was even worse than you feared.
Yeah.
He'd
had a good year with the Dodgers in 2000, but in only 90 games, he hit 24 homers, drove in 70 runs, hit 284, 375, 579. So they were like, ooh, this is going to work.
I mean, God, the guy, all right.
Yes. So he got hurt. I think he got hurt in 97. And so with him, because he only played 132 games that year, I think he got hurt towards the end of the season, which then opened up catcher in 98 for them to trade for Mike Piazza after his one-day layover in Florida.
That's right.
So stealing Piazza out from under the Cubs, who had been rumored to be the most likely location for him. But apparently the Marlins just couldn't be tempted by Pat Klein and whoever else the Cubs were. Would you like a Terry Adams? How about a Terry Adams and a Pat Klein?
Andy, I got to confess, that rumor never came across my radar, or I simply can't remember.
I think
that the Cubs were close to landing Piazza in 98.
They were supposed to get him. That was going to be there. There were two huge trades in 98 that the Cubs were all over.
Randy Johnson, and
they didn't do either one. But then they did make huge moves. We could save this for 98, but they did get Matt Karchner and Felix Heredia instead. So I mean, it's pretty much the same thing.
Yes, but they did have to give up Todd Noel, Kevin Ori, and all right, else.
And then John Garland to get.
That's the big one. That's the legit. Yeah,
Dylan Cease of a previous decade.
So then
Hundley went around and wandered around in left field, and made Kyle Schwarber look like Gary Pettis.
Right. Yeah, it was a disaster. But he regrouped for that one year in LA, like you said, and that salvaged his. He got a multi-year deal, and only Andy McPhail was dumb. You know, it fit with the thinking at the time, right? He was maybe a useful player still. He was a local guy that probably can't hurt. You know,
so, this Cub roster is a testament to how good their farm system was back then. So their most commonly used catcher was Todd Hundley. First base was Matt Stairs. Second base, Eric Young, who came from the Rockies with Don Baylor.
Free agent signing, yeah, yeah.
Shortstop, Ricky Gutierrez, who came from the Astros.
Yeah.
Coomer played third base. And if it wasn't him, it was Miller, and he wasn't one
These
of theirs
These are all,
either.
Like, middle-aged veterans.
Yes. Left field, Rondell. Center field, another legacy, Gary Matthews Jr.
Oh, Buford, too. No? Oh, maybe not. Okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But also
Sam Enright, Bill Miller. Here's a homegrown guy, Joe Girardi, 36 years old.
And a second go-around, yes. You're 36 years old.
He'd been gone for a decade.
Yes.
Delino DeShields played some left field and second base.
They acquired him at the trade deadline, actually, and he was terrible, really. He won one game, but... Because here's the thing. Here's one thing that I'll remember. Just a weird fact. Eric Young was with the Cubs two seasons. He came in with Baylor, like you said. He was phenomenal in 2000, man. He was like, oh, this is a leadoff hitter. He got on base. He played a good second base. The Cubs were terrible in 2000. And it was one of those funny things where in 2001, Cubs were good, and EY really sort of regressed. And yes. Like, damn, why couldn't you have had the season you had last year, this year?
His on-base dropped to .333, and while he stole 31 bases, he got caught 14 times.
Wow.
So that's pretty bad. That's not to say, well, and then other luminaries, Damon Buford, like you mentioned, Sleeves.
Sleeves.
Son of Don Buford. Apparently, Ed Lynch... When he was accruing talent for this team, if your dad played the big leagues and he'd heard of you, then he signed you.
Okay. Once again, though, I have to say that I don't think Buford probably was acquired.
That's what I was
by
thinking.
Lynch
I think some of these guys were from the year before. They were
because Lynch was let go halfway through the 2000 season. So this is the first season going into the season where it's all McPhail. And I just want to say then, going into the season, whether it's McPhail or not, it's McPhail. Because he was above Lynch. Either way, though, what you're just describing here with all of these like 34-year-old position players around the entire goddamn diamond, this was the seventh season of the McPhail slash
the master
era.
Plan was really showing itself. See, former Marlin Todd Dunwoody played 33
Can
games
I just
for the Cubs.
Raise a toast to having seen Todd Dunwoody with my dad in Kane County in 1994 against the Appleton Foxes and Alex Rodriguez. And I don't remember. I don't remember what Dunwoody did in the game. I do have a scorecard buried somewhere in my house. I can tell you that future LSU quarterback Josh Booty went 0-for-4 with 4 strikeouts.
I did remember at one point thinking, if we're going to get a Todd, why couldn't it be Hollinsworth? Well, hey, that happened. After he won a World Series and then fouled the ball off his knee cap.
I just don't think Todd's work out with the Cubs.
No, certainly not the current one either. So there were some prospects, some stars. Julio Zuleta, of course.
Big fan.
Was
big
this
fan
the year
Julio.
That Julio did the picking of the ivy? The ball went into the ivy in left field, and Julio, a first baseman by trade.
Yep.
But the living embodiment of Pedro Serrano went into the ivy and was looking for it and was literally just pulling out hunks of leaves and it was a home run for whoever.
Well, you know, maybe he at one point, I'm sure at one point we had convinced ourselves that maybe he was the successor to Mark Grace at some point in the season. He did hit a grand slam.
Oh, no, we knew who the successor was. He was working his way to greatness through the minor leagues. It was He Sop Choi. We knew that.
That's true.
Everybody was holding a seat for Hesop.
Yeah. We had Hesop and Bobby Hill. And actually, I had goofed up with Patterson. Patterson really was an unknown coming into the season. He'd only gotten a taste the year before.
This may have been. I mean, he was a flawed player anyway. But the fact that he played, at 20, he played 11 games. That was at the end of the year. That wasn't such a big deal. But in 2001, he had no business being in the big leagues. And he needed serious development. He hadn't hit above Class A, but they just kept promoting him.
At Class A, he raked at Lansing. at Arizona Fall League, he raked, and he was the youngest kid in the league. And so everything was looking great. And then the next year in 2000, in spring training, he fucking raked again. But it was like, all right, it could be misleading. And they're like, you know, even Baylor, who was the new manager, was kind of talking him up like, I partly think that they, you know, kind of got into his head a little bit. But then he went down like they prescribed and figured he'll be back. He went down and had a very mediocre season at West 10 at Double A. I remember this. And it was like, well, hey, let's put the brakes on it. Let's not now promote him like you thought he would, because he's clearly not maybe on the trajectory that we thought. And they called him up anyway. And I thought that was a bad precedent. Maybe sends the wrong message to him that maybe he doesn't have to work on this game. It's complicated. I mean, he did have some success. He was up and down. He did not start this season with the Cubs, right? How many games did you say he played in 2001?
59.
He hit one game. He hit a home run off of Roy Oswalt that year. You can look it up. It was in Enron Field. They still call it Enron. He had flashes. He showed some flashes that year. But, yeah, he was not – I was wrong at the onset to have him in that lineup. He was not really one of the core guys.
He walked six times that year. That might have been his career high. 33 strikeouts and six walks in 59 games.
But yeah, Julio Zuleta, I forgot about him. That's a good pull. He was a Pedro Serrano type character. My only two memories was one I heard on the radio, a grand slam he hit against the Cardinals, always good in early June when the Cubs were good. So these were big games. I remember being at a cold ass game in April where he hit one right down the line. Game was freezing cold. And if you can believe this, Bronson Arroyo was pitching for the Pirates and Zuleta freezing cold, wind howling in, and Zuleta hit a homer all the way down the line, which is, you know, hitting a homer down the line at Wrigley is probably harder than almost any other park, especially with the wind blowing in. But yeah, he had the makings of a legendary player, except he couldn't, stop striking out, I guess.
So this Cubs team, had a guy not – he was not a Cub prospect, although he spent a lot of time in the Cub minor leagues. He originally was a Brave and then a Marlin, and the Cubs picked him up. This was a guy who won – he won a batting title in AAA. He's an outfielder. Do you remember this player? He hit .352 for the 2000 Cubs in 45 games.
So it's not Eric Hinsky. Is it Todd – is it Todd – wait, Chad Myers? No.
No, it's Chad a guy Myers was on the know. Team. But no, this guy hit .346 at Iowa.
And .346 in Iowa. And what did he, in 2000?
Actually, 2001. But he came up and played for the 2001 Cubs. And he played for the 2000 Cubs.
2000, and he's a former Marlin and Brave.
Yes.
Or future Marlin and Brave.
No, he was former Marlin and Brave. I believe he may have gone off to Japan.
Oh, Michael Tucker?
No. Tucker, we haven't got to the trades yet.
Okay.
Roosevelt Brown.
Well, I hated Roosevelt Brown.
He was a terrible outfielder.
Roosevelt Brown reminds me, I will always associate Roosevelt Brown with the stink-ass, early-ass days of the internet when all I had access to was Cubs.com and ChicagoSports.com, which was the wing of the Chicago Tribune. Andy, I had not discovered DeCipio or Balls, or as I said, until 2003. So in the meantime, I can just remember raging against people anonymously on these Cubs message boards who were daring to just talk up Roosevelt Brown like he was really the answer. And it drove me crazy, and it didn't help that Roosevelt Brown was always terrible.
So as you mentioned, Sammy Sosa. Sammy had won the MVP in 1998, and he hit 60 homers in. He hit 60 homers again in 99 or 2000.
He hit 300 homers in a 5-year period beginning in 98, of which 2001 was a 60 homer season. Yeah. I'm pretty sure.
So he hit 60 homers three times, 1998, 1999, and then this year. And he did not lead the league in home runs any of those years. But he did lead the league in 2000 and in 2002. He hit 50 in 2000. He hit 49 in 2002. So he led the league twice, but neither of those years. His 98 season.
What years did he lead the league? 2002 with 49? What
2000
other
and 2002.
2000 he did. Okay.
So in his MVP season in 98, he hit 66 homers, 158 RBIs. He hit .308, .377 on base, .647 slugging. He led the league in runs with 134, RBI with 158, strikeouts with 171, and total bases 416. Mm-hmm. In And in 2001, he had a better year.
He had a season for the ages.
So 64 homers, so two fewer homers, 160 RBIs, two more. But he hit 328, 437, mm-hmm. 737. His OPS was 1.174. He led the league in total bases again. It was the third time he did it. He also led the league in runs again with 146. And for the only time in his career, and since we just talked about all of the duds that were on this team, he led the league in intentional walks with 37. That's a Barry Bondsian number.
He was 37. Yeah, he was a shade off of Bonds.
Yeah, so it was Sammy's best season. It was an amazing season, given that in 98, he had better offensive players around him. In 2001, he had nothing. It was all, if Sammy didn't beat you, you didn't get beat.
All he had was a gimpy Rondell White, and that's it. Yeah. That's it. I mean, if you look, and one of my favorite things to do, and I should have it committed to memory, but I don't. If you look at the discrepancy between Sammy's team leading, which was probably about 160 RBIs, you may have already said it, and whoever was second, which is Ricky Gutierrez,
yes,
who is, I think, almost one-third as many.
Well, I think this has to be a record. I don't know for sure, but Sammy had 94 more RBIs than the next Cub.
Sammy had how many?
He had 160. Ricky had 66. 94 more RBIs than anybody else on his own team.
Oh, very nearly three times as many.
Yeah.
Which, yeah. And so when I say at the beginning, oh, I kind of have nostalgia. You know, I have fond memories of the 2000, and I do, of the 2001 Cubs and how they, you know, they spunkily were in there. The real what's burying the lead here is the fact that they were a one-man show, at least on offense. The pitching had to be there, and it was.
This could be a game show in itself. Let's play. How many more did Sammy have than the next guy? So
they're all over 100 after Greg, because Gutierrez was second.
64 more home runs. He had 64 home runs. How many more do you think that he had than the guy who finished second? And I'll tell you, the guy who finished second, it was a tie. Matt Stairs and Rondell White.
So I say Matt and Rondell both had under 20. That's all I'm going to say. I'm going to guess 16.
They had 17. So he had 47 more homers than anybody else. So he had 47 more homers and 96 more RBIs than anybody else. He had... Let's see, what did he lead the league? He did not lead the team in triples. Ironically, this is pretty impressive. I'm going to make you guess. Who led the Cubs in triples?
Was it Corey Patterson?
No.
In his limited play.
The reason it's impressive is that this guy only played 63 games for the Cubs.
Really?
And he had 7 triples. You just mentioned him. His eyes were completely bugged out of his head at all times.
And I just mentioned him?
Yeah. I said we haven't got to the trades yet.
Oh, Michael Tucker?
Michael Tucker. 7 triples in 63 games.
Wow. Okay.
All right. Sammy led the team in... Sammy did not lead the team in doubles. Who led the team in doubles?
And Grace was gone?
Grace was gone.
Rondell.
Eric Young. He had 43.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Let's see. So Sammy led the team in walks. With 116. How many more than the next guy?
75. I'm going to say the next lowest would be, what is that, 40-something?
It was Matt Stairs. He had 52. So what is that, 64? So Sammy had 64 more walks than the next guy.
Over double.
He also struck out 64 more times than anybody else. Todd Hundley. Todd getting it done. 89 strikeouts in only 79 games.
Yeah.
And, Hundley struck out 89 times in 246 at bats. He struck out much more than a third of his at bats.
Sounds about right.
His numbers for the season are majestic. 12 homers, 31 RBIs. He hit 187 with a 268 on base and a 374 slugging.
Can I just enter one more Todd Hundley thing into
the
record?
He was Yachty without the defense. His OPS 67.
Before we shift and get into other things such as the Steve McMichael Angel Hernandez game, which definitely happened in 2001. But before we get to that, with Todd Hundley, if I could put a coat on it, just to finish it, we started the story. He shows up, not really beloved to begin with, doesn't get a start on opening day, gets butthurt about it because Baylor starts Girardi, and finds himself in this platoon, even though he's getting paid. He's a little bit of a red ass. He's terrible, as you've already described. He's terrible all year. And here's my memory of that season and Todd Hundley's role in it. And I have a very specific memory about it, is that at some point in June or July, he got hurt, was put on the DL, and they called up Robert Machado. It was basically Joe Girardi and Robert Machado. And I'm not saying it's because Tony was gone. I'm just saying, you know, that things clicked. And the Cubs, you know, were in first place for most of that summer. You said 96 days, and I'm sure most of it was in the summer. And I just remember that Hundley was ready to come back from the DL. And I'm just like, okay, well, look, they got a good thing going, right? I'm thinking in my head, I know you're a competitor, whatever, but like, just stay out of the way. And it was like, but just the impression I had, and I know that this isn't how it would really have gone down. Just like, it's just like he had to throw himself back into the team. And I was at a game, I don't know if it was against Houston. It was, you know, every game was important. These are legit. These are exciting games. Those of us that lived through 84, 89, 98, you really recognize that in August, you're going to the park and they're all big games, legitimately, not some sort of fake we're alive like in the last week of the 95 season. Like, this is a team that's 15, 20 games over 500 and everyone's important. And Hundley was back from the DL and he forced himself into the lineup, and it must have come up like two or three times. Huge situation. Just had the weakest at bat, three pitch strikeout pop out. It was just infuriating. Like, what are you doing here? He couldn't take the hint, and that's all I'm going to say about Todd Hundley.
So I assume this was 2001. It could have been 2000. I don't know. It could have been 2002. No, I think it was 2001. Do you remember the game at Busch Stadium? It was a warm day in St. Louis. And the Cub catcher passed out.
No, I don't.
That was
Todd.
I thought
you were going to tell another story.
He landed in a big heap behind home plate, sweating profusely. Chip was a little concerned as to how much he was sweating on a day that was warm, but not that warm. Almost as though there were toxins in his body that were trying to get out at a day game in St. Louis after perhaps a long night the night before in St. Louis.
Right, which may or may not have been related to a 4 a.m. appearance at Mike Shannon's bar or the Budweiser Brewery or the Anheuser-Busch Brewery.
Signing autographs for Josh Hancock and the boys.
The last one that I'll just point out to, and I don't know if it was in 2001 or two, was, and I believe our good friend Mike Brett hired Jim Essie and had chronicled this one time where Hundley, after hitting a home run, flipped off the Wrigley Field fans. So, which I'll admit, sometimes there are fans at Wrigley Field that deserve to get flipped off, but let's not mistake that Todd Hundley was just all bad. So
yes, a legendary season for Sammy. His last truly great season.
I guess.
Pretty good in 02, still productive in 03, and then he was gone by the end of 04.
But even in 04, he probably knocked out 30 dongs. But yeah, no, I agree. And it's funny because last week we did 1992, and you know, it was a totally different Sammy. I mean, it was equally exciting. He always had the flair, but it's kind of funny that, you know, we're examining a guy that swings from his ass, and you had what seemed to be unlimited potential, and then 9 years later, we're seeing this guy that is absolutely steroids or no steroids. Not the issue. It's just, like I said, everything being relative, he was absolutely one of the giants of the game, and that season statistically is just bonkers. And that 2001 Cubs team is not in contention, obviously, without that type of production. It's all they had.
So 2001 also, and Corey Patterson, I guess Corey had actually debuted in 2000. A future Cub fan favorite also made his debut in 2001, pitching out of the bullpen. Do you know who that was?
I know. I do. Big Z, baby.
Yes, Carlos Zambrano got into six games late in the season. He even made a start. And things did not go so well for Carlos, but he was but a pup. He was 20 years old.
He made a start on the back end of a doubleheader in a series against the Brewers in which Juan Cruz, I believe, may have also made his major league debut. And what's interesting about that, Andy, you'll recall us stat geeks, Cub geeks, prospect geeks back then, Zambrano had been on our radar for a couple of years, I want to say, by then, 99-2000, and Cruz sort of came out of nowhere and surpassed him. And they both got called up, I think, the same week in September of 2001, but Cruz was a little bit more of the steadier, you know, he got off to the better start, I think. And, you know, Zambrano, took him a little while. He did make his debut in 02. He thought he'd made the roster, but he had a shitty spring, got cut, and then, but got his act together, came back down the stretch and closed out some games. And then from 2003, the rest was history. But yeah, I forgot that, that Big Z made his debut in the 2001 season.
Yeah. So, so you're right. Disco Juan Cruz had one of the most interesting seasons all in 2002. I'm only going to bring it up now because there's no way I'm going to remember this in 2002. I remember chronicling how good he was at one specific skill, and that was giving up unearned runs.
I think somewhere in the recesses of my mind, I remember that.
If there was an error, Juan was like, okay, now these will all be unearned, so fuck it. Hit it as far as you want. I don't care.
Heaven.
He was, in 2002, he was 3-11 with a 3.98 ERA.
Wow.
In 97 innings, he gave up 13 unearned runs.
Wow.
43 of his 56 runs allowed were earned. It's the only time in his career that he had a significant spread like that. So it was apparently a one-season skill for Juan.
Okay. Well,
but it also was the 2002 Cubs were dog shit. I'm sure they were punting the ball all over the field behind him. But
100%. 100%. Yeah. You know, and that just sort of accentuates this on again, off again part of the Tribune, the latter half of the Tribune ownership, where, you know, they could be mediocre, which is what they're striving for. They could be good like they were in 01, or they could be terrible like they were on each side of 2001. Where'd they win in 2001? They won 88 games. So should we talk about that, the hottest day of the season when Steve McMichael was invited to take me out to the ballgame before or after we already kind of covered the three back, we'll get into the three back breaking games because it really defined the season. I was at this game, and I'm going to really kind of bring an obscure fact here that nobody's going to be able to verify, but I know it's true. So take my word for it. If you will, but you don't have to. You mentioned, you made a reference at the beginning, Andy, to high def, and you said something like, well, you know, high def wasn't around then. So blah, blah, blah. In July, I remember for this game. In fact, I went to this game. It's beside the point that high def was out. I mean, the technology was there, and it was about to hit the market, and it actually was hitting the market for fat cats that wanted to pay for it and could get the programming.
Was this like how the Cubs played the first game ever broadcast by satellite to Europe?
It could be.
Jack Brickhouse got all excited about that.
We would need some geek, way geeker than me. I don't know if it's some combination of your guy in the Northwest Indiana and whoever. Who's the guy?
I'm not asking George Castle shit. Okay. So, no. That's not happening.
What I remember, because I remember like at work, like talking with a coworker, where he was going to go to Best Buy to watch some of the Cubs game on high def, and they were like they were actually kind of advertising it, like Best Buy. I assume it was Best Buy. Any of those types of places that would be the first retailers to sell somebody, you know, what would it be, like a $4,000 high def TV in 2001, that, you know, in order to generate sales, that was one of their things, that they were going to have the Cubs game on high definition. So getting that out of the way, because I know that I can marry that fact to this game just because I remember when it happened. And then there are so many other events about this game that etched it in my memory. So we're talking about a game against the Colorado Rockies in 2001. If you have the screen up, you may have to help me, but it'd be
August,
July.
It's August 7th. And
you got a game time.
And I'm disappointed. No, the Baseball Reference does not have the temperature. I'm going to assume it was 106 degrees.
They do if you scroll down underneath the box scores, I think. Like they have that other weird.
You're right.
And what was the game time temperature?
92.
Yeah, it's 7 o'clock.
Wind blowing out
at
to center at 12 miles an hour.
And that's true.
Imagine what Marquee could do with that stupid wind graphic on this game. When they replay it, they'll have to add that.
All right. So let me tell you, having been to this game, Andy, I can tell you that I have no recollection of any wind. and you know, anybody that knows me knows that I, you know, of my hobbies, you know, like, you know, collecting baseball cards and, you know, record albums and sweating. I'm very good at sweating. So, you know, I can, it can sometimes be a little problematic when I'm out in high temperatures. And so it leaves an impression, just like I leave a stain on my seat. So, just for illustrative purposes, another reason why I remember, how, you know, I remember this game because it was unbearably hot, 92 degrees at 7 o'clock. Another thing I remember about this game was one of the very, very, very few times that Fred McGriff got a clutch hit, especially off a left-handed hitter. It came around the sixth or seventh inning. You might remember the oddest of pitchers, a left-handed submariner named Mike Myers.
Mike Myers.
Not related to the...
Born on Friday the 13th, I think. Or maybe he died and was reincarnated on Friday. I don't know how that works.
That's another one. Okay. Myers was a left-handed submariner. At one point in the game, he came in to get out McGriff. Now, we can talk about McGriff later or now, but just suffice to say that most Cub fans, not a fan, mostly because he got off on the wrong foot by delaying his waiving of a no-trade clause from a dead-ass Tampa Bay team to saunter on up to Chicago. But
he didn't want to come. He didn't want to leave. He liked it in Tampa. He didn't want to, leave. Right.
But nevertheless, he did show up, and eventually, you know, he would always put up his numbers, but he was a disappointment. But in this game, just in fairness, state for the record that Fred McGriff did tie the game up in the later innings with a clutch hit off a left-handed submariner.
It was two runs scored on that hit. It was a 2-1 Rocky lead. He singled a right off of Mike Myers. Michael Tucker and Ricky Gutierrez scored. Sammy Sosa advanced to third.
And then
who came up next to drive him in with a sac fly? Everybody's favorite all-star, former Cub and all-star, Ron Coomer. Gave the Cubs an insurmountable 4-2 lead. You can't blow this. You're not going to blow a 4-2 lead to the Rockies because you've got David Weathers coming in to pitch the top of the eighth.
Okay. Now let's do that. Now let's reset it once more and go back chronologically, because so that was in the bottom of the seventh, huh? I didn't remember that. I didn't remember the Cubs took the lead. So So if we back it up then from there, what's going on in the game? It's kind of the Cubs are in contention. I don't know what Colorado is doing that year. It's a hot ass night. It's kind of, you know, it's a midsummer night.
Well, they didn't have Don Baylor anymore, so they were rudderless. They've been 2 years without
Cubs,
there.
Cubs had Baylor. Yeah, I don't know if it was Leland or what in the Colorado dugout, but. So what happens was that, and I can't recall what play it was in the fourth or fifth or sixth inning. Some point in the game, there was a close call that legendary noted umpire asswipe Angel Hernandez had blown. And you know, this is 2001. I mean, you Google Angel Hernandez today, and you'll see instances of him just,
he did it
being
just,
a boob.
We're recording this on Wednesday the 7th of April. And on Tuesday the 6th, he missed two of the worst ball strike calls ever.
Can't wait to look it up.
They're like, ooh, Angel is in midseason form right away.
Yep. And so this is 20 years ago. This is two decades ago. Hernandez blows a really bad call. So the hot, angry, frustrated crowd lets him have it. All right. Like I said, it's a full house. Everyone's a little cranky. You know, the Cubs are doing good. So we've got a little more of a, you know, extra incentive here. We're a little extra juiced here. It's the cocktail, perfect cocktail with the heat and the frustration and the excitement and the pennant chase. And so, everyone probably knows what I'm about to describe here. This is the one reason why this game is really remembered, was that the Cubs were in the fourth season of honoring the late Harry Carey by having a celebrity guest conductor sing Take Me Out to the Ball Game at the bottom of the seventh. And on this hot day, this hot, wild night in July, former Bear, defensive lineman Steve McMichael, who has been given time, plenty of time on a remember this crap Bear style. McMichael, being a former WWF wrestler, in addition to being a Chicago Bear, very much of a showman, made a big show of having some speaks with that home plate umpire. And of course, the crowd just starts erupting, right? This public spectacle of this big, you know, this big man that's, you know, got the microphone and there's 40,000 people looking at him. He's singling out the home plate umpire that we were already mad at. And so it's pretty much whipping us up into a frenzy. And of course, Angel Hernandez has no idea how to defuse any situation. He, of course, takes the bait and he turns around and kind of does this sort of equally WWF showy hands on his hips and trying to stare down McMichael. And that was that. He ejected McMichael from the park. The crowd was obviously fired up, and then they go on. Everyone was so fired up, Andy, that Fred McGriff got a key hit off a left-handed pitcher. And then there's one more thing, how the game ended, that we have to discuss. But the only other thing I'm going to say about McMichael's appearance that topped it off was how immensely uncomfortable it made his subsequent interviewer in the bottom half of the seventh inning, one Chip Carey. And that's something you might have some memory or some thoughts on.
I don't remember. I don't remember exactly. I know that Chip, I'm sure, was aghast at the behavior of Steve
McMichael. McMichael got escorted out in mid-interview because he had been ejected from the game, first of all. Which, of course, made it safe for Chip to, you know, to then act outraged. And not outraged. I'm sorry. That wouldn't, you know, he wouldn't do that because, you know, he wasn't going to take a stand like that, but he'd let you know that maybe I'm wrong. I mean, we got to find footage of that. And if we do, terrific. We might not have footage of the interview.
What I know we will have, footage of will be the final play of the game. One of the most entertaining ends to any Cub game of all time.
Yep. Yeah, so tie game, was it tied by then?
It was tied.
Yeah,
yes, tied.
Yeah, tie game.
The combination of, I can't believe this, the combination of David Weathers and Jeff Fassero couldn't hold on to a 4-2 lead in the eighth, so it was tied. The Farns had a restored order in the top of the ninth, so okay. It was still
Farns
tied
had a good
going
year.
Into the bottom of the ninth.
Probably one of his best years, that idiot, so okay.
He
still tied.
And the worst part about it, the rally that that tied the game for the Rockies was started by a triple by Juan Pierre.
Of course.
I'm sure he'd spent the pregame rolling his balls down the first and third base lines, as Len Casper once famously told us that he liked to do.
Yes, he did.
He actually said he rolled his balls down the first and third base line. I don't want to see that, but I'm sure it happened.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I pulled the game up just because I can't. It was a rundown of colossal proportions, of course. And but it would appear that in a tie game, you had.
I believe that what happened to the star of the rundown, Ricky Gutierrez, I believe he Cal Daniels'd himself.
Oh, that's it. That's exactly what happened.
He was on second and shocked as everyone that Joe Girardi got a hit. That he rounded third aggressively and fell right on his ass and then got in a rundown.
That's right. But, so he was on because he was on second base with one out, first and second. Girardi lines a single to left, and it was one out. I don't remember if it was right to left field, but Ricky's trying to score. It's ball game. It couldn't be a game winning hit.
It was a single to left. If it had been the center and it was Juan Pierre, he could have fallen down and crawled home and he would have beat the throw.
That's right. Right. So he.
But I think Adam Melhuis was in left field, and you can't run on Adam Melhuis.
Never. Never.
I would even try.
So we'll pull up the video, I'm sure, and post it. But I think so. What would have happened, of course, is that Gutierrez had to run back to third. But of course, at that point, Sammy never the most mindful
base
runner.
Sammy and Joe Girardi were having a tea party at second base together.
That's what it was.
Which made no sense. Because why Joe could have basically just parked his ass on first.
Well, and Sammy, that's true.
Sammy was, you know, being Sammy.
Yeah, what was Joe thinking? Well, Joe was thinking if he gets thrown out, right? I want to end up on second base.
Well, there was two outs. Well, Joe's not trying to draw the throw.
No, there was one out. There was one out, right?
Maybe that's what Joe's doing. He's like, all right, screw it. I'll just get. I played for the Yankees and I learned how to do shit. And we're just
You got to get the second base just in case, and Sosa should get the third base just in case, which I think he was doing. But Sosa would have, of course, seen Gutierrez fall down because that was in his line of sight if you're running from second to third. So Sosa runs back, so that's where that happens. And then you had this carousel effect that I couldn't do it from memory.
Well, it goes the play was scored because there was an out recorded. Girardi got a single, but he was then out 7-2, 6-3, 1. But while they were running him down, Ricky got up and ran home and scored.
Yeah. Well, and that's right. He was holding, and then because after Girardi was out, then they throw home, but it's too late.
I'm doing this from memory, but I'm positive You'll be amazed. I'm positive Chip completely fucked up the call.
No.
So now I can't wait to find it.
Yeah, there could be some more gold in there. It was a close play at the plate, and that's what kind of just sort of bookended or tied the whole evening in, because they get Girardi, and at that point Gutierrez is breaking for home, and they throw to home, and there was a catch and a tag, and we were waiting on the judgment from Angel Hernandez, who this time, you know, ruled in favor of the Cubs, and of course we went bonkers. We all went bonkers. So, yeah, kind of an epic. One of those epic, you know, regular season nights when you go to the park, you don't expect that you're going to see some game that you'll be talking about 20 years later. But anyone that was at that game assuredly remembers it.
All right. So if you bear with me for one momento here, I'm going to try something that may or may not work.
You're gonna drop in Chip. He's so reliable that even without you like listening to it beforehand,
I don't need to hear it.
It's probably a good bet, Eddie.
So here we go.
Let's hear the call.
Oh, it's Joe Carter.
Yep, defense. Joe Carter.
And when you have all those ingredients, add them all up, it's going to be 1- and 2-run ball games.
Broken bat, flare, left field, base hit, Ricky around third. Here comes the throw. Oh, Ricky fell down. And now the Cubs have runners all over the place.
Why are we yelling?
Fasano throws to second. Girardi in a run down between first and second.
Shel Fasano from Schaumburg High School.
Let's Girardi up. Oops, nobody's at first. Oh. There's the tag out. Runner coming home. He is out.
Yes. I knew it. He is out. No, Chip, he's not. They just won, dumbass.
Oh, he did blow it. He totally blew that call at the end. First of all, he provided. I'll let it run.
It was a play at the plate before, and now Angel Hernandez calls him safe. What a way to end the game.
All right.
He not only blew the actual sequence, which I get it was unprecedented and weird, and you're on TV, so you don't have to be so literal, but he didn't really, you know, he had a Fasano catching a ball and stuff, but then like he gets himself so amped up. He's such an animatronic dingus that like he can't just chill and like see Angel Hernandez clearly give the pass interference, the universal call for safe, and he's like calling him out. It's just bedlam.
So I think I wrote about this. I don't think we talked about this. I wrote about this when so Pat Hughes did like 3 spring training games, and he's gonna do I think 8 marquee games during the season. And it confirms when you watch Pat does radio on TV. He can't not help himself. He's going to give you every pitch location, and that's fine because he's good at it. So it really doesn't, it's not distracting. It doesn't matter. But the thing you notice with Pat, which I've always assumed, is that he does the thing all good announcers do, is he doesn't tell you what happened until it happens. Chip's biggest problem has always been that he anticipates what's going to happen. Yep. And 50% of the time he's wrong. Mm-hmm. And it's like, we can see it, moron. You're not. He's the opposite of Jeff Joniak. Jeff won't tell you what's happening. Chip will tell you what isn't happening. Mm-hmm. And that's just a perfect example. All he had to do was watch the tag. We can see it. And then when Angel calls him safe or out, you say what he said. And he didn't. And he blew it. But it was great.
He just works himself up into a frenzy. I got to say something. I got to say something. I can't have a gap in my thing. I can't have a silence. I got to, you know, it's just like, chill, dude. I mean. Yeah, he did not disappoint there. That's great. That is fair. Out, save, yay! Just yelling. Just like, are you a mental patient?
Can you believe we made it through an entire season? We lived through an entire season of Joe Carter and Chip Kidd.
Two.
So that's right. What year did Jim McMahon show up in the booth and Joe asked him if he ever talks to Pete Rozelle, and Joe had to tell him that he died?
Right. I think it was either 2000 and 2001. Or 2001 or 2002, where Steve Stone had some mysterious illness.
He had valley fever.
According to him, went down to Arizona.
Fuzzy lung.
to retire or whatever. And so the Cubs tried this thing where Joe Carter would join Chip Carey on all of the Channel 9 WGN broadcast, and our good friend Dave Otto would join Chip on the back then I think it was Fox Sports Chicago. And that was before Stone came back. Stone actually did come back in September, and we can go into this because we're getting down the stretch, and I know we're almost done, but in September, Santo, you know, was, I don't know, maybe had to have more of his leg shaved off or just couldn't do a series in Florida. So Stone joined Hughes in the booth. And I remember thinking, like, shit, I mean, I know we have opinions on Stone. We'll get to him because he's in almost all of these seasons, at least through most of them. But by and large, you know, his smarminess aside, even back then, you know, a competent analyst, you know, he doesn't get in the way. You know, he has his downside, of course. But I just remember the Cubs were alive in this season in 2001, and Stone joined Hughes. And I just remember thinking, that's a perfect, like, wasting all our time. There's Stone with Chip Carey, and then there's Pat Hughes with Ron Santo. And it was, like, nice to, like, listen to a game where, you know, they worked well together. And, you know, I'm not, you know, not always going to say nice things about Steve Stone, obviously. But I will say that, yeah, he actually was not a Cubs broadcaster that year, but he did do a couple games with Hughes on the radio. It does sort of bring me towards the last 6 weeks of the season when the Cubs tumbled out of the race.
Yeah.
Do you remember?
Well, the most famous example of that, as I just pulled up, was earlier than I thought, but it was August 2nd. They're in San Diego.
That's the game. Game number one. Check. Game number one. All right, so the last 2 months, I was wrong in my memory. Without even looking at it, Jason Bure was the starter. Jason Bure had a nice season. We talked about Fassero blowing that Colorado game that we just watched. And I always felt bad because Fassero held the fort down, did everything he could in April and May, and he was just getting tired. And what I remember about this game, and maybe I'll be wrong, but I feel like Jason Bure pitched his best damn game of the season, and that Baylor pulled him too soon after six just to keep doing his formulaic go to the bullpen. I remember thinking, like, look, the bullpen got you here somehow. You know, Tom Gordon got healthy. He came back. Somehow the bullpen has this mediocre team in contention. Let's stretch the starters out. Bure was freaking cruising in that game, and the Cubs would have taken 2 out of 3. They, you know, McGriff actually had a homer in that series the night before. They needed to take every series, even against, you know, teams like San Diego. And I'll let you take it from there because this was the rubber match. The Cubs had won a game. They had lost a game. And I don't know where they were in the standings. But they must have still been in first because you said they fell out August 17th. Yeah. So,
Cubs were 62-45.
17 games over.
And after the game. So they were 62-44 going in.
Mm-hmm. Chance to go 19 over in August.
Jason Bure had gone 7 innings, allowed 3 hits, struck out 12, and had only thrown 102 pitches. That was the that was the rub. It was you squeezed it out, but he had it. I'm sure Groove is thinking, well, got a 3-run lead with my lockdown bullpen.
Yeah.
Why would I let Bure get in trouble in the eighth and then they have to clean it up? I'll just let guys handle it.
So
he went to the mighty Jeff Fassero, who had to get through the it's impossible to get through the heart of the Padre order.
Is D'Angelo Jimenez one of the guys?
Yes, D'Angelo Jimenez, Alex Arias, and even then a very old Ricky Henderson.
What are the odds that Alex Arias would be mentioned in consecutive podcasts 9 years apart since he was a Cub in 92?
So shit goes sideways right away.
Yep.
D'Angelo Jimenez gets a single to right. Alex Arias comes in, and he has to pinch hit for the guy who had pitched the inning before, who would go on to get the win, even though his main contribution to the game was that he gave up the fourth run. He gave up an RBI single to Fred McGriff.
That's what I was thinking of.
It was former Cub, one of your favorites, Chuck McElroy.
Oh, another guy mentioned
everything. Everything always comes full circle on this podcast.
I'm just going to say that we can talk about, when we talk about 91 Cubs. I looked up Chuck McElroy after that. That guy actually has a transaction history, having been traded for a veritable who's who of guys. We can get to that later, but I guess I'm not surprised that McElroy was mentioned again.
So Fassero gives up a single to D'Angelo Jimenez. Then he gives up a single to Alex Arias. And now he pitches to Hall of Famer Ricky Henderson. Strikes him out. Of course, that's what he does. So he's got a 3-run lead. There's two guys on. The last thing you want to do is put another guy on. And so he walks Mark Kotze on five pitches. The great Mark Kotze. That brings up Ryan Klesko.
And Baylor leaves him because lefty-lefty.
Right, you got the lefty-lefty, and so you're going to go to Ryan Klesko, and Ryan Klesko hits a ball to Tijuana.
Yeah, he did. He crushed it. And the game went from 3-0 to 4-3, right?
Yep, 4-3. Go to the bullpen, bring in the Farns to close the door after all the horses have been frolicking on the beach. Yeah. And he strikes out Phil Nevin, another future Cub. And
another the guy mentioned last week is incredible.
And the great Bubba Trammell. So okay. Now the only thing between the Cubs and disaster is they just all they have to do is scratch a run across a completely in his prime Trevor Hoffman. And they're going to do it with the following with Ricky Gutierrez, Ron Coomer, and Matt Stairs.
All right, so maybe the 2000 Cubs weren't meant to be.
Ricky grounded out to second. Coomer flew out to center. But Matt Stairs walked. So bring
Atta
in,
boy, Matty.
Put the tying run on. The winning run is at the plate. And apparently, every Cub in the dugout had already been used.
In a nine-inning game?
It had to be because Don Baylor let Todd Hundley bat against Trevor Hoffman.
Oh, I remember it, actually.
And Todd Hundley struck out.
And and a ball in the dirt, but, you know, Trevor Hoffman. So a week later, they fall out of – so that's back-breaking loss number one. A week later, they fall out of first, but they're still alive, right? First place, you know, you're around first place in mid-August. You're alive, even if the division sucks. And, you know, it really didn't. Next game, I'm going to ask you to flip to another rubber match around Labor Day weekend in Florida. And so same thing as San Diego. The Cubs split the first two. And that second one was the game where I remember Steve Stone was doing these games on the radio. Because I remember listening to the second game where Josh Beckett made his major league debut. And the first two Cub batters both swung at the first pitch, which was driving Stone a little bit crazy. But in the third game, I think it was might have been on Labor Day. Because I think it was at my brother's when the game started. It's like a holiday. Maybe
no,
not.
You must have been playing hooky from work. Night game, September 5th. Wednesday,
it was a
September
Wednesday.
5th.
The first game of the series was Labor Day. That's what it was. So Wednesday game, I couldn't tell you any details about this game. Feel free to fill us in. All I remember, Cubs had a two-run lead, bottom of the ninth. I believe there were two outs before Tom Flash Gordon served up a lead-changing three-run homer to Preston Wilson. Just another that was that of the three games that we're going to talk. That was actually the worst. It just was. It was a game ender. Klesko's wasn't a game ender. It was just late inning. You just felt. I mean, this team had fought, rallied around that one and a half offensive players, Sammy and Rondell. They're alive. You just need Tom Flash Gordon to frickin' close the game out. Instead, he serves up a three-run bomb to Preston Wilson.
So, The Cubs had gone into the top of the ninth. They had 5-4. And then young Corey Patterson hit a one-out double. Eric Young drove him in with another double.
Some State Farm insurance runs.
Armando Almanza is pitching for the Marlins, and he's so rattled, he then walks Michael Tucker ahead of Sammy Sosa. So here's Sammy with the Cubs up two, with two on, in the middle of his greatest season ever, and he grounded into a double play. This is brilliant. I'd like to, Sammy didn't ground in a double play. There was a double play. Sammy struck out and Eric Young got caught trying to steal third base.
Oh my God.
But doesn't matter. Cubs have a 2-run lead going into the bottom of the ninth. Flash Gordon finally back from his various ailments. We don't have to fuck around anymore with Jeff Acero and the
yep.
Farns and David Weathers.
Yep. Yep.
And future Cub John Mabry leads off with a base hit. Everybody's favorite Luis Castillo grounded out. That brought up future Cub Derek Lee, who Flash hit. So now there's two on. And another future Cub, Cliff Floyd, comes up with a chance to win the game. But he flies out to center. So now Flash is simply he's
two-run lead.
He's one out away. He's not even one out away. He's one strike away because he has a 1-2 pitch to Preston Wilson. And Preston hits a three-run homer. And the Marlins win.
The only batter of the inning who was not either a past or future Cub ends up getting the...
Well, not Luis Castillo.
Right, yeah. But still, I'm sorry, you're right. But, of course, inexorably linked otherwise.
You either were a Cub or a Met. Or in Cliff Floyd's case, you were both.
Yes, that's right. So that's backbreaking loss number two. Now, backbreaking loss number three happens a few weeks later. Of course, 9/11 happening a Tuesday morning. Yes.
All right, I'm going to admit something very bad here about 9/11.
Yeah.
I'm going to actually call this. I need to look at this here. So obviously, 9/11 happens. It's horrible. I saw the second. We'd been alerted at work that the first plane had hit, so we ran to TVs to see what was going on. We saw the second one. It was every bit as horrific as people think. And mm-hmm. I had tickets. The Cubs were supposed to play in Milwaukee that night.
No, Cubs play the Reds.
I'll play on the 11th. Yes, I had tickets. I had tickets. I had a date. We were going to see. I had season tickets to Brewers that year, so we were going to the. I was taking her to the.
That night? Yeah, it could have been the Reds. They played the Reds the night before because the aforementioned Roosevelt
Brown. We might not have been going to see. It doesn't matter. We might not have been going to see the. Where I was going to a Brewer game, and then it got canceled. And then it became very clear that, as the day went on, that is, actually, as the morning went on, you knew it was horrible, and then everything was going to have to shut down. And it wasn't then. I got home and just watching the coverage. And for the fleetingest of moment, I remember thinking. Because the Cubs were one game out of the wild card behind St. Louis at that point. They'd fallen to third place. And I remember thinking, well, maybe this time off would be good for the Cubs. That's not a good thing to be thinking at that moment, but that's what I was thinking. How can the Cubs use a horrible terrorist attack?
Your John McKay jokes about them being one good plane crash from having a competitive
team. What if this is what turns it all around?
Boy, you know what the Cubs could use, man? They just got punched in the nuts by Preston Wilson. They're really – they could use a week off. You know that? Nice job, Andy. Nice job.
Okay. So is your game number three the first day back, Tuesday, September 18th,
yes.
against the Reds?
So,
which is most famous for what? What's it? What do people think of it now as being famous for?
This actual Cubs game?
Yes.
No. I'm sorry. No, then it wasn't the first game back because the first game back was at Wrigley Field. They resumed the season, and that Cubs-Reds series was interrupted. The first game back was Sammy Sosa hitting over.
Yeah.
So the backbreaking loss
home game was the – everybody remembers it for
– Right.
Sammy gave Billy Williams a American flag.
A prop.
Sammy hit a home run. Billy handed him the flag, and he ran around the bases holding
it. That's right. No. So, all right, same team, the Reds, different venue. It was in Riverfront because Great American Ballpark opened in 03. Kind of similar in some sense to the Preston Wilson game. It was an ugly, bad game. And I think Todd Walker was on the Reds because he did something in that game. Future Cub at that point, Todd Walker. But it was kind of a back-and-forth game, shitty Reds team. But the Cubs still managed to, like, take the lead by maybe just one run in the top of the inning. So, if you look for a walk-off loss.
Oh, you'd be wrong. Once again, the Cubs went into the ninth with a one-run lead. And this time,
Insurance
it's amazing
runs.
How much he pops up. But former Cub and All-Star Ron Coomer. Drove in Delino DeShields to give the Cubs a two-run lead going into the bottom of the ninth. Now they're in great shape.
Here's poor old Ron Coomer busting his ass to get the Cubs in the playoffs and they can't get out of their own way. And so we already it's actually perfect that these are the three games that were the signature games that drove this Cubs team out of contention because their bullpen carried them, and yet the three best bullpen pitchers that year, Jeff Fusaro, Tom Gordon, and now it's like not to be outdone. Here comes Kyle Farnsworth in for the save. Just like Tom He got two outs, I want to say, but it was future Brave Brady Clark, I want to say.
Yes.
And I can remember the ball that he hit. Two outs, and it was a lead-changing hit. Again, lead-changing, not just a walk-off hit, but a lead-changing, meaning if you don't get a hit, the game's over and you lose. If you get a hit, you might win. Pops one up down the line in right field. And I don't know if it was Sosa, and I'm not blaming Sosa. It was a fluke hit. And the ball just bounced right inside the foul line.
So you're saying that Sammy Sosa and Fred McGriff couldn't chase that thing down? Nobody could.
Was McGriff still in the game even? I guess in fairness, it was the third and final gut punch because those are just, you can't come back. You have three games like that in 6 weeks. It's obviously not your season.
So, but there
are games you have in the hand.
Fred didn't play.
Okay.
Stairs played first, and then Coomer came in for him. Rondell White did play, though, so it was one of his rare appearances.
Okay.
Yeah, so the ninth inning with the Cubs coming to it with a two-run lead, Farns gets off to a great start. He walks Sean Casey.
Okay.
Gives up a single to Aaron Boone, then a single to Dimitri Young, and that scores Sean Casey. So now it's a one-run lead. But he gets a Wilton Guerrero, Vlad's little brother, and Vlad Jr.'s uncle, presumably. Yep. He bunts. Of course he bunts. Jesus. So now Aaron Boone is at third, and Dimitri Young is at second. Jason LaRue is up with a chance to win the game, and the Farn strikes him out. Yep. So now everything's fine, because here's this slappy little Brady Clark. He's not going to get a hit. The Cubs have their chances, odds of winning are 75%, thanks to Brady Clark.
The Farnsworth-Brady Clark matchup.
It then shifts to the Reds' winning percentage is 100%, because Brady Clark hits a single to right, Boone scores, Young scores, Cubs lose.
Yeah, and that was basically game, set, match. San Diego, Fassero, Florida, Gordon, Reds, Farnsworth. There was a few other heartbreaks after. I remember the aforementioned Gary Matthews Jr. came back for Pittsburgh against the Cubs and hit like a big homer. But in my mind, it didn't matter, because after the Cincinnati game, it was like, you can't come back from those three types of losses like that in a 5-week period. And that was it. It was a weird feeling. It was, like I said, up until then, I was 29 years old in 2001. The Cubs were terrible when I started following them. Out of the blue, they win a division in 84. They go back to sucking. Out of the blue, they win a division in 89. They go back to sucking. Out of the blue, they win a division in 98. They did have 500 teams in 93 and 95, but they were not real contention. And so here comes 2001, where we're actually, as weird as it feels, because the team mostly sucks, we're used to the Cubs competing and finishing the deal, because that's what they did in 84, 89, and 98. All other seasons, they just didn't compete. And so it was a weird feeling to like, oh, this is what those DeRocher era Cub fans mean about fading. Because I'm like, man, that's all bullshit. In my life, Cubs are, you know, it might say more about them that they're rarely in position, but when they are, they close that shit down. But in 2001, we finally got a taste of a team that was in legitimate contention and just, you know, sort of faded out and had a few, you know, crushing losses that we've great detail on that, you know, pretty much marked it.
So a couple bullpen guys that we need to talk about quickly here at the end. The Cubs had a former number one overall pick stashed in their bullpen in both 2000 and 2001. Todd Van Poppel pitched 11 years in the big leagues, and Todd had two good seasons ever.
Both with the Cubs?
And they were both for the Cubs.
He was good.
2 years with the Cubs, he was 8-6. He pitched 110 games out of the bullpen. He had a 3.18 ERA. And he struck out 176 batters in 161 innings. So he's a little over
inning.
And he then went to the worst possible place he could the next year. He went to Texas, where he was from, and where he'd already been there once. And things didn't go very well for poor Todd. But he should have stayed with the Cubs.
And I'm going to ask you for your – because I have a feeling you have a pretty good memory of this. Van Poppel was one of the more celebrated first-round picks, partly because he engineered some controversy by, what was it, like not wanting to go to the Atlanta Braves, which is ironic because he might have gotten himself into a farm system that at that time was actually –
Well, that's right. He was not number one. And it was because of that. He did not want to – the Braves had the first pick, and he didn't want to go there. And so Scott Boras was his agent. And so they basically said he's not going to sign. He is going. He's going to go pitch at University of Texas. He loves college. Okay. He's going to Texas. He's not going to sign. So he was not the first overall pick. He was the 14th overall pick,
and
the
A's somebody still took a flyer on. Okay,
in a pick they got as a compensation from the Brewers. I would love to know who the Brewers
and then also at the time, because it was like the rich getting richer, right? It's like the the Lakers drafting Magic. I mean, the A's were in the midst of their dominance, such as it was with, you know, Dave Stewart and Bob Welch and Dennis Eckersley, and it was like, hey, this guy might be around, but he muster for them.
Well, and it was the 1990 draft, so the Cubs didn't have a good pick because of their the 1989
team. They were at the bottom of the round.
So they picked towards the bottom, but it was a good draft. The number one overall pick was Larry Wayne Jones, better known as Chipper.
Chipper.
Tony Clark was the number two overall pick to the Tigers. Mike Lieberthal to the Phillies. Alex Fernandez, four, to the White Sox.
Mike Lieberthal's been mentioned. Okay. They've all been mentioned on the podcast already. Then, Lieberthal and Fernandez have been.
Then you get Dan Wilson to the Reds at seven. The immortal,
Barrington High School.
The immortal Tim Costo was the Indians pick at eight. Jurassic Carl Everett, was picked by the Yankees.
A lot of memorable players. This is the, what draft is this?
1990. Future Cub Shane Andrews, picked by the Expos, the 11th pick.
Hey, we mentioned Willie Green last week, and I roped in Shane Andrews because that was their third base combo in 2000.
Pretty sure Donovan Osborne pitched for the Cubs too, right?
He did in 1996.
Yep. He was the 13th pick to the Cardinals. Cardinals took Osborne one pick ahead of the A's, finally said, fuck it, we're taking Van Poppel, and they took him and they signed him. Also in that first round, Adam Heisdew, Jeremy Ritz.
Pittsburgh, right? Heisdew came out with Pittsburgh.
The Orioles made a relatively good pick at 20. They took Mike Mussina.
Ooh, Hall of Famer. Yep.
Steve Carsey at 22, one pick ahead of the Cubs. And who do you think, ironically, who do you think went one pick after Lance Dixon? It would have changed the, if the Cubs had taken it, it would have changed the course of his entire career. It was Rondell White.
Oh!
He would have never played on the crap turf in Montreal.
Yeah, he would have been a perfect replacement for Andre Dawson in 1993. My gosh.
Let's see, Midray Cummings, remember him?
You know what? If Dallas Green was still around in 1990,
Future Cub Scott Sanders was the 32nd pick of the Padres. Kirk Dressendorfer. The A's took him with the 36th pick. He's had a really long name. And the other bullpen guy I wanted to talk about, because it's a dispute that no one will ever be able to settle, is who is the greatest baseball player ever to come out of South Holland, Illinois?
Well, Clifford Floyd, right?
Was it Cliff?
Maybe.
Was
maybe
it Mark Mulder? South Holland. Or was it Ron Mahay? Because did you know this? Ron Mahay was basically the Shohei Ohtani of his time. Ron was drafted as an outfielder by the Red Sox. Ron made it to the big leagues as an outfielder. Flamed out and then made it back as a pitcher and had a very long career as a relief pitcher. For a guy who had already failed as a position player to come all the way back, it's pretty impressive. And he was actually for the Cubs that year.
I know the name now that you mention it. I would never have been able to recall it on my own, and
on a technicality, I think I'm going to lose the argument here because he's from Palos. He went to South Suburban, so he's not from South Holland. So that's
I'm pretty sure that disqualifies. Yeah, it's back to Floyd and Mulder, but Rod Mahay, vaguely. That's one he that kind of fell through the cracks.
Ron Mahay, after playing five games as an outfielder, hitting 200, returned to the big leagues like 7 years later, something ridiculous. Maybe 5 years later. He would go on to pitch 14 seasons in the big leagues. And he had a 383 ERA. As a reliever.
Wow. Not bad. In his career. He earned that pension. A couple of last random facts that popped into my head. 2001 was also the season in which John Lieber and Kerry Wood threw back-to-back one-hitters, I want to say. That would have been late May, and I'm going to tie this in.
That's no big deal. If you just pitch against the Cubs this year, you can do it.
Well, I think one was against the Reds.
The last 2 days.
I think one was against the Reds, one was against the Brewers. And I'm going to tie this in because I know it happened right around the same time. I think it may have been the day that Lieber one-hit the Reds. But there was one time the Cubs caved and let Ronnie Woo Woo sing Take Me Out to the Ball Game. God. So that happened in 2001. So I think we've covered most of the facts. I don't know if I've, if anything comes up, I'm sure we'll. I mean, Jesus, we mentioned Mike Lieberthal has been mentioned in two of the first three podcasts. So ultimately, I think everything gets covered.
You can't have a baseball podcast without a Mike Lieberthal reference.
It was fun remembering Rondell White, though. He was one of the finest right-handed hitters in my memory that played for the Cubs. I'm going to have my last drink here to Rondell White.
He was a really good player.
Just couldn't stay healthy.
You know, who did they trade? Last thing before we go. Who did they trade to get Rondell White? It was a one-for-one deal.
Was it Scott Downs?
Scott Downs.
I don't know. I just pulled that out of my
head. That trade still haunts Andy McPhail to this day. Because Scott Downs went on to superstardom. with
the Chiefs. I just you kind of did, but like 10 years later, I'll just the last one was I saw Scott Downs pitch in 2000. Maybe I'll save it for 2000. I'll save it.
Yeah,
that's what I'll do. Scott Downs comes up.
We can't waste
all the good material, man. Keep it in the keg.
All right, so we remembered a lot of crap about the 2001 Cubs.
For a relatively good team for once, but still plenty of crap, obviously. You take Sosa off that team.
They're the best bad team the Cubs have ever had.
Were they a bad team? They won 88 games.
Well, that's what I mean. They were the best bad team because other than Sammy, there's not much there. And
no,
they won 88
not.
Games. So I think they're the best bad team.
Okay. Better than 98? 98 might qualify as a good bad team.
That's true.
We could talk about that when the wheel lands on. Let's make a note that whenever 98 comes up, we'd maybe do a little comparison there.
Right.
So I think we could do that.
All right. Well, until next time, Mike.
Sounds good.
All right.
Many of us have herpes.